Accession number 19531, Real One.
Mr. Bates, Real One, where were you born, please?
I was born in Surbiton, Surrey.
Which year was this?
1924.
Did you grow up and have your education in Surbiton?
Well, I went to Kingston Grammar School, which was just down the road, and afterwards to the School of Oriental and African Studies in London.
To study what?
To study Japanese. I was part of a joint Army Board of Education scheme in 1942, when the services realised they were pretty short of people able to speak Japanese in the military sense.
Had you been particularly interested in languages at school?
Yes, languages had been my stronger point, I suppose. Mainly French.
What was the course like at SOAS?
Well, it was a 15-month course. It started in May of 42 and it went through to August 43. It was actually combined with courses in Chinese, Turkish and Persian for various other groups of people. These are all people actually just about to leave school and go into the service anyway, and they tried to select a number who were strong in languages, who were likely to be commissionable material, if you like. So the idea was always they were given state scholarships in Oriental languages. It was always intended that they would be of short term and we would all be distributed between the services at the end of it.
How proficient did you become in that period?
Well, we became fairly proficient in colloquial Japanese. Obviously, the written language, which we also studied, is a great deal more complicated. But we came out with an adequate knowledge, enabling us, for example, to read simple diaries of Japanese soldiers, which is a constant theme of captured documents, you probably know.
How was the subject taught at SOAS?
Well, we had there's a permanent staff there, dons, some with Japanese wives, some Japanese civilians who had taken British nationality, and we also had a number of Canadian nisei from the Canadian Army who were seconded to help on the colloquial side. They weren't particularly academic, but they were very useful for conversation practice.
And was technology used in those days to teach it, or was it just book and blackboard?
No, I suppose you might say it was a very early version of the language laboratory. Gramophones and recordings were used a lot, and hearing yourself repeat the lessons was all part of the drill, so, which is now very much more sophisticated, of course, but it was quite a pioneering activity, I think.
And what were the main problems that you found in learning Japanese?
Well, I suppose the main problem was related to the written language, where one had to memorize as many characters as one could. I mean, the actual number we probably got hold of was about, I suppose, under 1,000. The ordinary man in the street in Japan needs several thousand characters to read newspapers, for example. But we have very good backup of encyclopedias and dictionaries. I have a very good Japanese character dictionary still with me now that is quite useful.
Could you ever get any kind of clue about the meaning of an item of vocabulary from the Japanese as we can with, say, French and German? Or was it totally mystifying?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, there is a certain similarity between English words and German and French words, but was there any kind of similarity ever with
No,
Japanese?
Not really. Although Japanese then and still now does use a number of foreign words, which are actually written in the kana vocabulary rather than with Chinese characters. So there's a certain amount, but not very much in the military sense.
how much pressure was put on you in the course?
Well, I don't think really a great deal. I mean, it was a full-time activity. We were billeted at Dulwich College, which was handy and available. And the college was about to go bust anyway, so they're very glad to have this sort of subsidy from the government. And we travelled to SAOS every day for the working week. Weekends are off. But I don't think the pressure was very great. Indeed, there were 30 of us on the Japanese course, six of us. By the time we got round to July 43, I reckon that we had done enough to go out and be useful in the war rather than carrying on indefinitely. And we were allowed to be released early. They reckon we had a sufficient degree of skill to be useful in intelligence terms. And so six of us preceded the rest out of SOAS. Went into the army, were taken in at Maidstone into the basic training depot there as private soldiers, and subsequently went out to India about in December, I suppose it was, and finally commissioned in India in the following February. Meanwhile, the balance of our course soldiered on until the autumn.
Did you have an exam at the end of it?
Oh, yes, there were periodic exams all the way through, but nothing dramatic.
Do you remember the names of any of the teachers?
Yes, well, there was Daniels was the leading don. He had a Japanese wife, I think Professor Edwards was the head of the department. I'm not sure about it. Daniel certainly was the one I remember most clearly.
Who was the outstanding teacher, if there was one?
Well, I don't think I would pick one out, especially they were all of a good standard. They, of course, like we, were doing something new. I mean, they had been used to research and to teaching undergraduates in order to get degrees. Ours was a shortened course, and so everything had to be tailored to that. As it happened, some of my colleagues went back to SOS after the war and did complete a degree. And one finished up as professor of Japanese, but that's another story.
Before you went to the school to do this course, had you been particularly interested in Japan, or did you just go on to the course because of the needs of the national war effort?
Well, I was at school having passed my higher school certificate, so I had a kind of year during which I was trying to decide what to do in terms of my national service, where I should be aiming for. In fact, I went in for the special entry exam to the Navy for Dartmouth, and it came out top with rather an achievement, but just found then that my eyesight was poor and I could only go into the accountants branch, so I ditched that. And the next thing that actually interested me was an announcement in one of the newspapers, I suppose about January, February 42, describing this intention of the government to recruit young men to go in for the Japanese language studies.
So, can you tell me what happened after the course, please, again?
Yes, well, I and my five companions joined up. We were sent to Maidstone, where we became members of the General Service Corps for the period of our 6 weeks basic infantry training. It was Royal West Kent Depot there. And we had a strenuous, interesting, exciting time. We'd all been in cadet corps at school, so we were fairly familiar with what went on, and we all enjoyed it. You know, we thought we were rather good at range firing and drill and all that stuff. And so it was a pleasant time, and August in Kent was lovely. And then at the end of our 6 weeks, we were sent off to the Intelligence Corps depot at Wentworth Woodhouse near Rotherham, which was where drafts were marshalled together for posting overseas, basically.
What about your voyage out?
Well, we Well, we boarded a troop ship in Liverpool called the Reina del Pacifico. It had been a South American liner before the war, and found ourselves on this ship with most of the 3 Commander Brigade, which was going out to the east at the same time. And so we left in December. I think we're the second convoy through the Mediterranean since it had been opened. And we were attacked quite heavily by aircraft halfway through, between Gibraltar and Port Said, that is. I suppose they must have been based in Italy. And one of the ships was crippled and had to be left behind at Port Said. But it was quite an interesting experience. We were down on the troop decks, you know, we still had private soldiers, very crowded, battened down, as it were, all the noise going on up top. And the aircraft, which we assumed were Italian or German, we didn't know quite which, were using that generation of radio-controlled bombs. So it was sort of quite an interesting experience. So they kept well out of the way and were able to guide their bombs into the convoy. As I say, one ship was hit quite badly, but managed to soldier on as far as Port Said, where they and indeed 3 of my companions out of our 6 were on that boat, and they had rather pleasant time waiting on the beach near Alexandria while the ship was repaired. Seaside holiday, really.
Was Reina del Pacifico hit?
No, it wasn't.
How alarming was that for you?
Well, it was rather exciting. During the raid, we were down on our troop decks with you probably know, the long tables with benches. There were various self-defense guns going off at the time, which managed to release sort of insects and cockroaches and things from the roof above us. So we were there sort of waiting for the bombs, actually being bombarded by insects.
And the rest of the voyage?
Oh, that was okay. We went through the Suez Canal and across to Bombay. It got hotter and hotter, of course, rather nice. And arrived in Bombay just before Christmas, I think.
What were your first impressions of India?
Well, as you probably know, you can smell India before you get there. I had never had any great desire to go to India in my youth, but actually I was delighted to go in the end. I came to love it. It's marvellous. It's a world of its own. Such a variety of climate and geography and peoples, languages. It was a great experience, I thought. But Bombay, for sort of newly arrived private soldiers, was it's sort of frightening in a way. You were surrounded by crowds of beggars, of course, or bootblack boys who threatened to put bootblack on your putties unless they were allowed to clean your boots. That sort of thing. It was very quite a challenging time. But we weren't there very long. We got on a train and were sent off to the intelligence corps depot in Karachi, which was an interesting experience. And as you probably know, Karachi is very different from Bombay. Sort of camels in the streets, and everything is very much dustier, more arid, compared with the humidity and warmth of Bombay.
What were you doing at the depot?
Well, nobody quite knew what to do with us, actually. It seemed as if we'd appeared without anyone being really ready to receive us. So we hung around there doing little or nothing apart from keeping ourselves clean and tidy. And then somebody realized that actually we should have gone to Delhi after all. That's where the language intelligence activities were based at that time. So we were shoveled off to Delhi and taken into what was then called CISDIC, you know, I expect, Confined Services Detailed Interrogation Center, India, which later became SIATIC, Southeast Asia Translation and Interrogation Center. And that was our sort of base, really, from which subsequently people were sent forward into Burma to join mobile sections, which we had established one section with each corps in Burma.
This was in New Delhi?
Yes, we worked in New Delhi, in Hutman's, by the wonderful Secretariat buildings, who you know probably, Lutyens buildings. But in fact, the Red Fort was, in Old Delhi, was where the prisoners were held, those that were still held for interrogation before, or further detailed interrogation, before being shot off to prisoner of war camps in the desert. And so that's where we had our first practical experience of talking to Japanese prisoners. Not many of them arrived at that time, but there were a few.
Was it done on a one-to-one basis?
2-to-1 usually, as we were still really in the process of familiarizing ourselves with the techniques and the reactions of the prisoners to our questions.
So who was the other one?
It would be one of the other people in our New Delhi headquarters, which was a mixture of people. There were people who had been in the Far East before the war and had been brought into the army because of their experience and language knowledge. There were one or two regular soldiers who had had interpreter qualifications. It was a mixed bag, really. One or two Indian officers who were also in that same category. Very mixed. In fact, the whole of our organization stayed that way. It was very mixed in every possible way.
So at first you were paired with an experienced interrogator.
Yes. When we'd been at the Oriental School in London, there had been service courses going through as well, short courses, mainly academics, mainly people who had language backgrounds. I have a couple of Welsh dons from Welsh universities. So they were interrogators. They didn't actually have any translation capability. We had done the longer course, which was designed to make us capable of doing both.
What advice were you given about interrogating Japanese?
Very little. It's a kind of make it up as you go along. You were merely told what the background of the prisoner was, and of course they'd all been interrogated before we got them. We were kind of using them as practice. And so when we were going over the long, rather dreary details of their experiences up to the point that we met them.
So you were trying to get at what people call hard facts?
Oh, yes. In fact, we were only, I think, capable of getting answers to hard fact questions. We were not sufficiently skilled in the language to embark on long philosophical discussions. There was a practical course and practical effects, rather.
So you weren't getting anything about their attitudes?
Well, you obviously form views of their attitudes in the course of conversations. But as I say, one stuck really to the facts rather than going any more deeply into their positions.
What was the physical setting of the interrogation?
Well, in the Red Fort, there is a rather cold stone rooms. They're not quite cells, but jolly nearly.
And you were just seated across a table?
Yes.
What kind of recording of what was said was done?
Well, at that stage, as I say, they'd been interrogated many times, and their answers had already been recorded many times. As far as we were concerned, there was no need to do that again. We just made a few notes and went along. But it wasn't verbatim.
What was the demeanor, typically, of the people you interrogated?
I would say it was patient, subdued. They got past the stage which all Japanese prisoners had to go through of shame and fear and wishing to commit suicide, having become this shameful thing a prisoner. They're well past that. They now realize that they were going to be treated reasonably well. They would get food and clothing and so on, and So there were no reservations in that sense. There was a kind of reasonable relationship, I think.
Was the atmosphere friendly, formal, or threatening?
I suppose it was a mixture of friendly and formal, really. There's no question of threatening. I mean, I think it had long been worked out that, and again, these were people who had been interrogated many times, that threats didn't really work. I think that later, as I found in the field, when we had prisoners only captured a day or two before, they were going through a traumatic stage during which they were quite fully expected to be killed, really. And the sort of the supply of food, drink, cigarettes, and kind of fairly friendly treatment transformed their attitude very quickly. They suddenly realized they were going to be able to live in a surrounding which was going to be congenial, you know, give or take a bit, and certainly better than being on the battlefield.
And so that did that loosen their tongues or tighten their tongues?
Well, I think it loosened their tongues. But of course, the other aspect one has to remember is that the prisoners we have are all low-rank prisoners. One didn't often capture an officer or indeed a senior NCO. They were usually first- or second-class privates, often captured because they'd been wounded. And so what they had to say wasn't all that illuminating.
So
they could take you through their journey from Japan, where they'd been in Burma, what they had done, very much sort of a geographical itinerary, and there wasn't a great deal more that they had to give us, basically. It was only later in the war that we managed to get higher rank prisoners who were a great deal more helpful in that sense.
And you say the organization you were working for came to be known as SEATIC?
Yes, Southeast Asia Translation and Interrogation Center, it stood for. And it was that was what the organization was renamed as after the establishment of SEAC, Southeast Asia Command. And as I say, there was a base organization in Delhi, Tri-Service, Anglo-American. We had an American commander at one time called Colonel Blunder. And we had mobile sections out in the field, and there was a fairly regular traffic between headquarters and the mobile section of people like me.
But at first it was called SISTIC?
SISTIC, yes. Well, we'll find that as quite a well-known term in the European theater as well, Combined Service Detailed Interrogation Center, SISDIC. It's a kind of generic title which was given to similar outfits in Europe.
What did the D stand for?
Detailed.
So you're in the early part of 1944 in New Delhi doing the interrogation practices in the Red Fort.
Well, and translation in New Delhi, yes. Yes.
What were you translating?
Well, there are many sacks of documents sent back from forward areas. Manuals, instructions, operation orders, personal diaries, very, very big item. All the Japanese kept diaries. In our services, it was forbidden. At all costs, never keep it out. Well, lots of people did, I believe, and I was very much on that line. No diaries, but every Japanese, from the lowest to the highest, kept a diary on him. And when he was captured, that was his kind of passbook.
How much did you learn from the documentary material that you were working on?
Well, to tell you the truth, I can't really remember too much about the detail. I think we produced précis of series of documents coming from one or other of the fronts in Burma. We tried to produce analyses of movements and of what we might call today the infrastructure of the services that we were opposed to. That period of my particular activity is not clear in my mind.
How long, in fact, were you in New Delhi for?
Well, I'm sure you know, there was a campaign season in Burma. Nobody did very much during the monsoon, except, until we got to 1945, I suppose. But there was operation was all suspended from May the 15th to September. The monsoon used to arrive punctually on May the 15th. And so in September, things sort of became active again. And that September, 44, was when I and two or three of my colleagues from SAS were sent forward to forward sections, to our mobile sections. And I went to number four mobile section, four MOBSEC, as we call it, SEATIC, which was at 15 Corps headquarters in the Arakan.
Any adventures on the way there?
Not really. It was all quite exciting. One was going forward. In those days, you know, as a young man, I was full of anticipation, really. Being sent east to the Brahmaputra and to forward areas, of course, was a sort of achievement of a sort, because we're all young and energetic and were fed up with being, you know, back at the headquarters in Delhi. We all wanted to go out and do our stuff in the forward areas. So we passed through Calcutta, and one of the amusing sort of badges you might know about is that you were not allowed to wear a bush hat until you got into the forward areas. And so as soon as one was posted, one rushed off and got a bush hat, which was terribly sort of exciting and looked rather, you know, daredevil. I remember that as being an amusing incident on the way through. But then I went through by train and by steamer down to Cox's Bazaar, where I was met by a chap called Dudley Sykes Thompson, who was the major in charge of 4 MOBSEC. Was swept off by him in a jeep to 15 Corps, which is just down the road from Cox's Bazaar.
Before we go on to the Arakan, whilst you were in India at this time in 44, what was the political mood or state of civil order in India from your own personal observation?
Yes. Well, as I'm sure you know, it's been said by many others, including Philip Mason, the army was insulated from politics. So one's contacts were very limited. One read the newspapers, of course. We were a year after the 1942 Quit India activity, at which time, you know, Gurkhas were armed all around Connaught Circus as a protection for the government and so on. But when I was there in 44, I wasn't really conscious of very much in that sense. And indeed, wish now I had been, because it would have been a useful and interesting experience to meet Indian politicians, Indian academics, civilians. But our contacts were insulated, you know, in the army. And the only people we really met were people who served us. I mean, bearers, hotel staff, mess orderlies, taxi drivers, that sort of thing, Tonga drivers. Hardly sort of suitable material for political discussion.
But did any of those show any coolness or hostility?
Oh, no, they were actually living off us, after all. We were the source of their livelihood.